Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're going to begin the show by talking with you about what's going on in the sky, in the night sky these days. And boy, there's something really fun coming up on the 27th of this month. It's a total lunar eclipse. Talk about it today and a whole bunch of other things going on in the sky with Jim Lattice. Jim directs the UW Space Place. And he's knows all about, obviously, the eclipse and a whole lot more about what's going on in the night sky. And you may have some questions or comments about what you've seen or would like to see. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. And Jim Lattice, welcome back. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
This total lunar eclipse has got a really cool sight, I would think. What's going on? For those who, how does that happen? What's going on?
Well, so what's going on is the moon basically passes through the Earth's shadow. So the Earth casts a shadow out into space on, you know, opposite the sun, basically. And the moon's orbit is tipped a little bit with respect to that shadow. So when the moon gets around to full, that's when it's on the opposite side of the sky from the sun, as seen from Earth. That normally what we see is the fully illuminated face of the moon, the full moon.
Sure.
But when things are just right, which happens a couple of times a year in theory, then the moon can actually, the full moon can pass through the Earth's shadow, and that's a lunar eclipse. So, but it happens because the alignment varies quite a bit. In fact, to the most full moons aren't lunar eclipses because the shadow isn't pointed in the right direction. But and the moon is tipped out of the plane. That's the real reason, not the shadow pointed in a certain direction. Most of them. Are some mixture of going deep into the shadow or along the edges of the shadow. And the shadow of the Earth itself has a certain structure to it, darker in the middle and partial shadow around the edge. So the dark internal part is called the umbra, and the partial shadow around outside is called the penumbra. So if you imagine being on the moon looking back at the Earth, with the Earth blocking the sun, if the Earth completely blocked out the sun, you'd be in the umbra.
Okay.
So no sunlight reaching your eyes if you're an astronaut on the moon. But if you see just a part of the sun, so if you see part of the sun peeking around the edge of the Earth, then you're in the penumbra. And if you see the full sun, then you're not in the shadow at all. So sometimes the eclipse is the moon spends most of its time in the penumbra. And in that case, the moon doesn't get very dark. There's still some direct sunlight, however little sunlight. There's still some direct sunlight illuminating the moon. And so we call that a penumbral lunar eclipse. And those are almost not noticeable. Unless you really knew to watch for them, you wouldn't even notice anything. But when the moon moves into the umbra,
different situation.
Now we're talking, right. Then then there's no direct sunlight falling on the moon, and there are two interesting things there. One is that the full moon, that bright full moon in the sky, starts to get really dark, and you can actually see the edge of the Earth's shadow on the moon that has a curve to it, which is the curve of the edge of the Earth. And because the Earth has a substantial atmosphere, which we know from watching the sunset, you can see the sun get red. Mm-hmm. That's the Earth's atmosphere reddening the sunlight. In effect, all the way around the edge of the Earth, again, you're imagining yourself on the moon looking back at the Earth, you're seeing all the sunrises and sunsets of the world all at once around the edge of the moon. And that light is reddened and scattered onto the moon. So the moon, as seen from the Earth, is illuminated by dim reddish light. And so you get varying degrees of it. Sometimes it looks hardly red at all. Sometimes it looks quite red, reddish orange, kind of a dark charcoal, almost like what the just visible glowing coals look like in your charcoal grill or something. So that's makes for a really wonderful sight. They're also really important, just historically, occurred to me to mention the fact that you can see that edge of the Earth and you can see the curve of the Earth. That's how the ancients, Aristotle, knew that the Earth had to be a sphere, because the shadow of the Earth, the shadow of a sphere, is always a circle, and the edge of the Earth's shadow, as seen on lunar eclipses, is always a section of a circle. So they recognized, even back then, this is just addressing the flat Earth myth, the idea that people used to think the Earth is flat. Well, it's been a long time since that. The ancient Greeks recognized, because of lunar eclipses, that the Earth is a sphere.
Well, now, is there... do you have any tips for just seeing this and, you know, sort of time of night and all that?
Yeah, sure, of course. So the, you know, one of the nice things about lunar eclipses is they happen slowly.
Mm-hmm.
They last hours. And so unlike, say, with a total solar eclipse where the totality lasts only a matter of minutes and you got to be at just the right place at just the right time and have just the right sky conditions, of course, like clear skies. So this one in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it actually happens on the next day in Europe because they're that far ahead. But for us, it's still on the evening of the 27th. And the technically that I mentioned that penumbral eclipse that actually starts at about 7:10.
Okay.
In the evening, so fairly early. Another nice thing about lunar eclipses is I don't have to give anybody directions on how to recognize the moon, right?
That's right.
You'll find it there. So, but it's interesting to watch and see if you notice any penumbral eclipse. But then it takes nearly an hour, a little bit after 8 p.m., 8:07 is the time I've actually got here, when the edge of the moon has moved through the penumbra and first contacts the umbra. So that's what we call the partial eclipse, the beginning of the dark eclipse.
8 o'clock, roughly.
Yeah, roughly 8. Yeah, that's the thing to remember. By 8:10, you'll definitely notice it. And then the moon starts moving into the shadow and into the umbra, and it'll be completely immersed. And the middle of the eclipse is about 9:47 is the time I've got here. So
okay.
9:45. So that happens, you know, nice and slow. If you're not right there at 8:07 or whatever, it's all right, you know, just or if the sky doesn't quite clear or something.
And it's not 3 in the morning either.
It's not 3 in the morning. That's the best thing. We had another one 6 months ago, not coincidentally, that was a nice total lunar eclipse, but it happened just before dawn. And so you had to get yourself up and out. And
I remember it. Actually, I was out doing my jog.
So I don't usually get up that early, but I got up that early to get a look at it because we had a clear sky. But this is much more convenient. Nice evening. You know, you can turn off the television set and go outside and watch the show out there. So middle of the eclipse, 9:45. So you got plenty of time to get a look at it. And then it sort of everything happens more or less in reverse. The moon starts moving out of the umbra at a few minutes after, I mean, at about 20 minutes after 10:24 is what I've got here, that the moon begins to emerge from the umbra. And then by about an hour later, 11:27 or so, the moon is completely out of the umbra. So that's when the most interesting part for most of us is over by then. But then there's still that last penumbral phase where the moon is still clearing that partial shadow. That goes on until about 20 after midnight, something along that line. So you got all evening to get a nice look at the lunar eclipse. And
does it enhance it if you can look at, you know, strong binoculars or a telescope or something?
You certainly don't need anything like that, which is another great thing about lunar eclipses. You just don't need, you know, any preparation at all. You know, a lawn chair, kind of like with meteor showers. You know, it's one of those things where you just want to get comfortable for a little while. But certainly use, unlike with meteor showers, where we usually don't recommend that you bother with binoculars or a telescope, because in the case of a meteor shower, the meteors are all across the sky, and that just really narrows, an instrument just narrows your field of view. But with the eclipse, since it's quite easy then to find the moon and aim your binoculars or telescope, it can be kind of fun to do that, especially during that phase when the according to the times I just gave you here, as the partial eclipse is beginning, starting a little bit after 8, the moon is moving into the umbra, and you can, with binoculars or a telescope, you can see that shadow creeping across the surface of the moon and
probably
darkening
more
the features
clearly.
Quite a bit, So if you've got something available like that, and it's not too important really what it is, a small telescope or binoculars, even low-power binoculars, can be a lot of fun.
Jim Lattice, our guest today, talking with him about the total lunar eclipse, but also just what's going on in this late summer sky. Hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. If you have a question about what's going on in the sky or about optics as well, certainly Jim is more than happy to talk about optics as well, telescopes and so forth. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or, again, post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Now, I've been out the last, well, I go out every morning about 5:30 to do a 3-mile jog around the neighborhood, and I've been watching Venus.
Yeah.
Venus is really bright in the sky about 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah, it's getting towards, we just had it in the evening sky a couple of months ago. It's crossed around in its orbit now to where it's on the west side of the sun, so it's coming up before the sun. And so that, we call it the morning star in this phase, right? And back when it's on the other side of the sun, then it's the evening star. It's at close to its maximum brightness.
Yeah,
so I'm not surprised that you're noticing that there. Yeah, that's our right now our most prominent planet, because we're actually kind of at a, for in our evening skies, we don't really have any planets right now. Saturn is just visible after sunset, but it goes down really soon after the sun. You can just catch it, but it's not prominent. It's not particularly bright, and then you know by 8 or 8:30, it's gone. So. And then we're out of planets until Venus rises over there in the morning sky before the sun. So we have to wait a few more weeks, a couple of months before we start getting some good planets again.
And I'm not ashamed to say that I thought it was Venus, but I wasn't sure. And I had my smartphone, so I pulled out Stargazer app, and sure enough, I had that information. Those apps are great.
Yeah, that's right. You used to have to, you'd have to go look that up in a magazine or even go to your computer and look on the web as an intermediate. But yeah, having that, you can have so much information. And there's some really good free astronomy apps out there to help you tell what you're looking at in the sky.
Absolutely. Ryan in Waukesha, excuse me, has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning. Just wondering from a your perspective, what would the Earth look like if you were seeing the eclipse on the moon?
Okay.
Well, we've got a pretty good idea what that would look like, although nobody's ever been on the moon during a lunar eclipse to look back at it. But you'd be looking at the night side of the Earth. So at the whenever you have a full moon, the Earth goes through phases as seen from the moon. And so when we have a full moon, we have what you could call a new Earth. So you'd be looking just at the night side of the Earth. You'd certainly see some lights on the surface of the Earth, human lighting. And the Earth is also fairly brightly illuminated by the full moon before and after the eclipse. And so you might, I'm not really sure whether you would see much illuminated by the full moonlight on the Earth. But during the eclipse, around the edge, you would see a prominent reddish halo, the scattered sunlight all the way around as the sunlight refracts through the bends through the Earth and is scattered through the Earth's atmosphere. So it would probably be a really wonderful sight.
Very, very cool. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. We had an interesting email question as well from Catherine, who says, we're cruising from Seattle to Singapore, essentially September 21st through October 27th, and we'll be 2 days north of Honolulu on the 27th. Will we see the eclipse, or is there anything else we should look for?
Well, lucky you to go to Honolulu, but I'm afraid that must be out near the western edge of the visibility of the eclipse. So it will probably, the eclipse, I'm not sure exactly for Honolulu, but that's about where the eclipse will be ending at about the time the moon is rising. So you probably will not see any, or at least not very much, of this lunar eclipse from out there in Honolulu.
But I would bet that you would be recommending some of these apps. Oh. Anyway.
Oh, yeah,
she was
sure.
asking about what else could we see or should we be looking for.
Right. What else could they look for? Well, you're right. So an app is a great way to go about that, although there are there's plenty of websites as well. So let's see. I don't know. One app that's fairly cheap that I like is called Stellarium, S-T-E-L-L-A-R-I-U-M. And I think they make it for – I know they make it for the iOS, for the iPhone. And I'm pretty sure they make it for Android, although I'm not certain about that. And it costs a dollar or two, I think. There are some much more expensive ones that are far more capable, but I use Stellarium a lot. I like to recommend it because it's cheap and capable. there are a few free ones out there, too. I don't use them quite as much, but there are many that will do the job for you. I think there's something called Starwalk, for example.
I was trying to remember mine. Stargazer, I think, or Star Tracker is what I've got. Yeah. Star Tracker, I've got.
Okay, is that a free one, or do you?
It's a free one. Yeah. I'm sure it's. I'm sure I got it free.
Yeah. So the only thing you have to do with the app is be sure, and then there's a bunch of them, and obviously there's no penalty in just downloading the free ones and trying them out. You'd have to be a little careful that you make that you know where the settings are, so that you can set. Your location, unless it's one of the ones that, well, a lot of them, maybe most of them these days, will just automatically get your location if you select use my current location. Then it'll figure out where you are and set the sky for that. But you need to know how to change that because it'll also use the current time. And if you want to know what's tonight, for example, then you have to, and especially if you're in Madison and you want to know what'll be visible in Hawaii on that night, then you've got to set the location to Hawaii and you've got to set the date and time. So you make sure that you know before you set out with that app, don't just download it and then leave. Make sure that you know how to set the time, date, and location on the app. And, but that's usually pretty straightforward. It's in the settings generally of an app.
Jim Lattice, our guest faculty associate in the astronomy department at UW-Madison and director of the UW Space Place. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the night sky with Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, a faculty associate in the astronomy department. Great to have him along on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we're going to talk about the discovery of the first animals on land and the discovery made right here in Wisconsin. There's a book about it now. So looking forward to that as well. But for now, if you've got night sky or star questions or maybe telescope or binoc questions, call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if got a question or even a photo to share, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and you can post right there. And I know we've got some and I'll find that.
You know, now that you mentioned photos. That's yet another great thing about a lunar eclipse is that it's, that's a nice one there. If you get your almost any sort of camera, really, although something that has a sort of a, that you can zoom in a little bit on the moon is better, so a longer focal length lens. But almost any camera, if you put it on a tripod, and if it's a camera that has any sort of manual settings, if you can set it for a long exposure, a few seconds that is, rather than a 60th of a second or something, it's really fun to play with photography during a lunar eclipse. A lot of people go to my friend John Rummel here in Madison. I know has plans to do a really nice time sequence. He's done these before,
but
he sets
cool.
up the camera and does multiple exposures. And catches the eclipse in a sequence, kind of like a time lapse at all its interesting stages. But you don't need, again, John knows what he's doing, but you don't need anything really fancy, especially these days with digital cameras. It's a lot of fun to play with that. You have to play around a little bit to find maybe the right exposure and things like that. But you got plenty of time, again, with the lunar eclipse.
And William on Facebook sent us a shot from the last lunar eclipse. So that's a really pretty.
Is that the one last spring?
Yeah. That's the one from last spring, and it's a beautiful shot. Go to our Facebook page. The title's The Larry Mueller Show if you'd like to take a look at it. And, you again, join us at 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. We had a question from a caller. I've been seeing meteors coming from the northeast to the south. They've been in the same spot every time. Is this a normal thing?
not normal.
Well, kind of depends on over just what period of time we're talking about. It's not at all unusual to see meteors on any given night. They're certainly not restricted to meteor showers.
Right.
Showers are just when we get especially high levels of activity. There's kind of a constant infall of stuff from space. They're usually called sporadic meteors if they have no association with any particular meteor shower. But there are also quite a lot of meteor showers. We often just think about the Perseids in August, for example, or the Geminids or something. The popular ones are the ones that happen where there's a lot of meteors, and they are good for us, say, in the northern hemisphere. There are other ones that would be better in the southern hemisphere. But there are really meteor showers happening on and off all the time. Mm-hmm. So you could very well be seeing a few meteors that seem to be following a similar path at a similar time that be associated with a minor shower. We'd need to, in order to try and identify the which shower, we'd need to have a little more detail on the specific paths. But it's not unusual that there's a meteor shower going on at any given time. But sometimes they're at a very low rate, like just a few per hour, which is the kind of thing that normally you wouldn't notice unless you're actually looking for them.
And then there's light pollution, which, you know, eliminate. Unless you're someplace dark, you're not going to see.
That's right. The vast majority of them we don't see because of light pollution. That's true also of the shower meteors, which is why we always suggest if somebody wants to say, look at the Perseids, the most important thing you can do is look for a dark sky. And also the second most important thing to do is to look for a shower that happens when the moon isn't bright. The moon is just that backlighting. Quite aside from light pollution from human sources, moonlight brightens the sky enough that you miss an awful lot of the meteors. So a favorable meteor shower like the Perseids last month happened pretty much close to new moon. So we had close enough to new moon that we had a dark sky.
I've been so fortunate to, in November, be in northern Wisconsin and in a cabin and out nowhere. And boy, the sky is just pitch black. And to see the showers.
Yeah, the Leonids are a good one in November.
It's really, really, really a treat. I want to go back to moons for just a minute, because we had all these other moons. We had a Hunter's Moon, they call it Harvest Moon.
Yeah.
Blue Moon. Super moon, which I'm not even sure what a super moon is.
Well.
Or is there?
Well, so some of those are the harvest moon. In fact, this lunar eclipse happening at this full moon, this full moon is the full moon closest to the autumnal equinox, which is when technically summer ends and autumn begins, right?
Mm-hmm.
The full moon that's closest to the autumnal equinox is called the harvest moon. And it actually is astronomically special because the moon rises a little bit later each night because it's completing its orbit around the around the Earth, and the inclination of its path in the fall, the inclination of its path with respect to our horizon in the northern hemisphere, is lowest. That is to say, it's not moving directly towards the horizon, but at kind of an oblique angle. And so that setting time, the delay in setting in the autumn near the autumnal equinox, is the smallest for any full moon in the year. So what that means is you get the visual effect of the moon rising at almost the same time for several nights in a row. For about a week, the moon seems to be there. It seems like it's the full moon's there every night at about the same time. Whereas normally, you'll see the full moon one or two nights, and then it's moved enough in its orbit that you don't notice it there at that same time anymore. So that harvest moon is kind of hanging out there, that rising out there on the eastern horizon for a few nights, and that's the effect of the harvest moon. And there's a good astronomical explanation for that. Then traditionally, the one after that is called the Hunter's Moon.
Okay.
And there are names for these moons, and there are actually multiple names for them at various times, although the harvest and hunters are very common. But in the spring, you've got the strawberry moon and the milk moon and all these things that relate to often agricultural cycles or that are just traditional names for the moon. So harvest moon, hunter moon, are part of that set. We often hear blue moon.
Yeah.
And it's only fairly recently that the blue moon, as far as I know, it was just an expression indicating rarity.
Once in a blue moon.
Once in a blue moon, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then fairly recently, by which I mean in the last 50 or 60 years, it's had several different astronomical definitions. And the most recent one that has become popular is when we have a second full moon in a calendar month. So the lunar month is 29 and a half days, give or take. But calendar months are 30 or 31. And so there's enough time there to have a full moon at the beginning of a month and then have a full moon again at the end. And so then that second one is
called, the blue moon.
Is the blue moon, at least by this relatively recent definition. This doesn't, as I say, go back very far at all historically. It's not a time-honored tradition here. It's something some journalist wrote up, I suppose. But so that's the blue moon, and we hear that occasionally. It's actually maybe frequent enough. Those aren't that unusual. Every couple of years we end up with, or more often, we end up with two full moons in a calendar month. So that's maybe debasing that once in a full moon expression, once in a blue moon. Then you mentioned supermoon.
Right.
This is also a fairly recent sort of thing that we've begun seeing around. So the moon's orbit is not perfectly circular. So it isn't always at the same distance from us. And, of course, if it's towards the closer part of its orbit to the Earth, then it ought to look a little bit bigger because it's closer. And if it's on the, you know, more distant end of its orbit, then it ought to look a little farther away, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I don't know where this originates, but it's fairly recent. If that closest approach coincides close enough with a full moon... then that full moon ought to look, right? Stands to reason, ought to look a little bit closer, ought to look a little bit bigger. Yeah. And so they've taken to calling that a supermoon when the full moon coincides with what we call the perigee, with the moon's closest approach to the Earth. Now, it turns out that this lunar eclipse is also a supermoon. But I actually don't like to emphasize that very much because it leads people to expect... that they're going to see something. If it's super, then it must be worth going out to see, right? So when you have a super moon, it really isn't all that much bigger than your average moon. I put together a little scale model for myself. If you take a kitchen match, imagine the head of a kitchen match and hold it about a foot away from your eye.
Okay.
Imagine that's the disk of the moon in the sky.
Okay.
On average. Now move it a half inch closer to your eye. That's the super moon.
Oh.
So that match head now is bigger because it's closer. And that's about how much bigger the full moon is, the supermoon is, than the average moon. So it's not much.
Not much.
Yeah.
But that's a great analogy. That's a great way to describe it.
Yeah. So you don't see that much. So I don't like the term because it leads people to expect something that they could see. And you really can't perceive it. It's not that much of a difference. Without an instrument, you wouldn't measure the moon being any bigger. But this will be a super harvest moon lunar eclipse, if you like, so we can stack all that stuff up.
On September 27th. Right. Ron in La Crosse, your turn. Thanks, Ron, for calling.
Yes, last month I did watch the Perseids meteor shower, but I was in the city of La Crosse. And even though I didn't see too many, they come by maybe every 5 or 6 minutes or longer intervals. But I noticed after each one that I did see come by, there seemed to be a trail of smoke. Mm-hmm. I gotta swear, wasn't. And I think maybe the one benefit of watching it in the city is maybe some of the city lights help illuminate that trail of smoke that you wouldn't see if you were out in the country.
Hmm.
So that trail that you see, it isn't really smoke. But what happens is the meteor particle, as it burns up, the reason we see it is that it's passing through the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, at enormous speeds. And so the friction with the atmosphere causes it to not just melt, but vaporize. And it creates very high temperatures right along its path. And so it actually stimulates the molecules in our atmosphere to fluoresce a little bit, to emit some light for just a little bit. And so that's that trail. You're seeing the atmosphere cooling down by radiating energy away, that energy that was dumped into it, so to speak, by the passage of the meteor. So that's the trail. So it isn't really smoke so much as it is glowing atmospheric atoms there. And that's very high overhead. I mean, we're talking like 70 miles over your head, something like that. It happens very, very high in the Earth's atmosphere. So it isn't really illumination from the city lights there, but rather the afterglow, so to speak, of the passage through the atmosphere. So, and what you were seeing there is the brighter ones. The dimmer ones don't really appear to move leave much of a trail at all. It's the bright ones that will do that And so probably if you'd been a little bit further outside of La Crosse, you might have seen more of the dim ones as well. But in effect, you were getting a selection effect there, seeing the brighter ones, which are the ones more likely to leave a trail.
Interesting. Ron, thanks a lot for calling. And you know, big and small, I mean, what's the size? It doesn't really have to be a very big particle for you to see it.
No, it doesn't. They usually estimate, of course, these things don't survive to the ground, so we don't.
Right.
Only the really, really big ones do. And for the most part, the shower members come from comets, which tend not to be metallic and rocky material, but more icy. Yeah, you're probably talking about something like a grain of sand, somewhere, but a pea, something the size of a pea coming into the atmosphere would make a very bright meteor. That would be a super bright one. And the visible ones that you can still see are, yeah, grains of sand or some little very tiny pebbles like that. So
it's amazing,
yeah,
isn't it?
It really is.
We have lots of Facebook questions and comments, so let's take one here from Irv in Minocqua. What were the ancient people's perspective on the lunar eclipse? Could it be religious, or have you ever looked into that at all?
Yeah, that's I have not looked into, say, lunar eclipse traditions. People would see them as important events with possibly religious significance. At least in the Western world, they, except for some very special cases, they've been understood so well since antiquity that it's probably one of the celestial events that is so well understood that there was really no need to have a supernatural explanation for it. And even in ancient discussions of astronomy, the what's going on, the geometry of the lunar eclipse is very well understood. But that's the only historical area I've looked into. I would imagine if you looked into folklore, you could find plenty of stories about it. You often hear stories about solar eclipses because they're much more disturbing. But even those were, again, in the Western tradition. The ancient Greeks understood those, at least in principle, quite well too.
If you, Carl wondered if you could watch the eclipse from anywhere in Madison, where would it be? It probably wouldn't make a lot of difference except someplace dark.
Yeah, once again, that's one of the great things about these lunar eclipses is that you don't really need to find an especially dark site. You certainly want to. So it's going to be over in most of that time that we'll be seeing that lunar eclipse, that upcoming lunar eclipse. It's going to be on sort of the eastern half of the sky. It'll be over by about midnight, which is when the full moon is highest in the sky, crossing the meridian over into the western half. So you'd want to look for something where you have a clear view out to the east and southeast, and find something where you're not looking into any lights that are right in your line of sight. So, for example, if you found a place, here in Madison, we have a lot of lakeshore to choose from. So if you could get yourself on the north or northwest edge of a lake so that you're looking out across the lake, then you're not going to have any bright lights from neighbors or parking lots or shopping centers or whatever that you have to look past. But certainly you don't need to go to any great amount of trouble, because if you just find a spot where you're not looking towards bright lights, then you'll see the lunar eclipse just fine. That's a nice thing about it.
Here's an interesting question, too, from Robert. Can you explain the idea that space is endless? I have a challenging time grasping that concept.
Oof. Well, join the club is all I can say on that. When you hear a comment like space is endless, it's making a judgment based on what we can infer about the geometry of the universe as a whole. And although the evidence is not, certain by a long shot, on something like this, it does currently look like the universe is not finite. That is to say that if you started out at one place and kept on traveling, you'd end up back at the place you started. That would be what they call a curved space and a closed, universe. another kind of geometry would take you off forever and never bring you back. You could just imagine traveling along an infinite tabletop or something along that line. And the current evidence, it looks like the universe is more like the open tabletop than, say, the surface of a globe, where you would, which would bring you back. I'm using two-dimensional analogs to the the three-dimensional universe here. And the universe is clearly expanding, and it's almost certainly accelerating. All the evidence points to it accelerating, which means that the space that it occupies is actually increasing. So at any given time, the universe might not be infinite, but it apparently is growing without any bounds on its growth. So that's kind of where it is. So whether it's endless or not, it's also not endless in the sense of what we can see. There is an end to what we can see, which is the distance at which objects are receding from us effectively at the speed of light, as seen by us. They're not they're not traveling at the speed of light, but their recession speed out at the edges reaches the speed of light, and that puts a limit on what we can see. Another thing that places a limit on what we can see is conditions in the early universe. When we look far enough away, we reach a point where light can't penetrate anymore. Yeah. Light is scattered, and that also puts a limit. So astronomers talk about the visible universe. The visible universe is not endless. The visible universe is quite finite. But if we talk about what in principle is happening to the universe as a whole, which is, again, highly debatable, the evidence is conjectural on a lot of this stuff, the universe might ultimately not have any limit on its size. So that maybe is one way to think of the endlessness of it.
Very interesting. We have Marshall sent us a photo from October 8th, 2014, which is another harvest moon photo, which is beautiful, on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So please take a look at that. And, Jim, what's going on, by the way, at Space Place and events and so forth? Anything coming up?
So, you know what's actually coming up in the time we've got? I should just mention that a couple of times a year, there's an event called Moon Over Monona Terrace, which Space Place collaborates with the Madison Astronomical Society. And that's actually coming up this Friday. So weather permitting, although
tomorrow,
now the weather doesn't look so good. That's right. That'll be here in Madison, Moon Over Monona Terrace. You just Google for that and find the details. But tomorrow evening after dark up on Monona Terrace, weather permitting. Space Place, we have a regular series of events coming up. The Saturday morning family workshops at 10 a.m. every Saturday. Take a look at spaceplace.org, and you can find out about everything that's happening. We'll have a public presentation, a talk, which actually I'm giving in October, the second Tuesday in October. But you can find out about all the events on our website. Can I mention, I saw a telescope question up there.
Yeah.
I want to recommend something called the Galileo Scope, which you can order online, $25. I'm pretty sure it's $25. GalileoScope.org. Galileoscope, all one word, .org. You can order telescopes from them. We also sell them over the counter at Space Place, but you can buy it. You don't have to come to Space Place for them. And it's a good quality telescope kit that's a great starter kit for kids, and it's a perfectly capable telescope. It's a small one, but it's a perfectly capable telescope for anybody.
I bought one. And
oh, you did. That's right.
I bought one when it first came out.
I remember
and
that.
Put it together, and it you're right. And it was fun putting it together.
Yeah, it's a fun project. It's a great thing to do with your kids or something along line. But it's also it's the only per dollar or something like that. It's absolutely the best telescope kit out there. You know, you need to spend more to get more capabilities.
Sure,
that's always true. But as a starter place, that's the place to go.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Jim Lattice, faculty associate in the astronomy department at UW-Madison, and director of the UW Space Place. And again, go online to spaceplace.org. Spaceplace.org. And you're going to find it. We have a link to it on our Facebook page as well, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So we're certainly you're going to be easily find it. And don't forget, 27th, evening of the 27th is we should be out there looking at that moon because we got a lunar eclipse that night.
Go watch TV that night.
He said, don't watch TV. Go watch the moon. Well, some other things to look at. I tell you what, there is some very interesting material out there for you to look at in the way of fossils. Right here in Wisconsin, there's a really interesting mystery that's been solved, the mystery of the first animals on land. And there's a new book out on it, and we'll talk with the author of that book, Chris Gass, coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.